It's a pleasure to be back in California, especially at this time of the year. Okay. Oops. Okay. That's yes. Now. Okay. Great. So the title of my talk is TV Chrome Gravity in 4D Dimension, and it's basically work in progress with Steve Hsu at the University of Oregon. So here's the outline for the talk. I'm going to first give you a brief review of models with extreme dimensions and TV gravity. And I do apologize to experts already. I won't have the time to go into great details, but it serves as a nice motivation for what we have been looking at in the last month, which is whether one could have quantum gravity, whatever the theory is you have in mind, at the TV scale, and that in 4D Dimensions. I will present to you a little model that does the job and basically discuss its phenomenology. So one of the features of these models with extreme dimension and TV gravity is that people think that you might be able to create black holes at Tevatron or the Large Hadron Collider. And I will have to briefly go into the arguments for formation of black holes. Again, I do apologize to experts. I'm not going to have the time to do full justice to this field, and I'm still learning about it. But I'll try to go into these details to address the question of whether our model would predict black holes or not. Then I'll come on the last part, which is really phenomenology and how to bound these ideas using cosmic rays experiments, and we'll then discuss NHC signatures and come to the conclusion. So we know of two very different scales in nature. One is the Planck scale, 10 to 19 GeV. The other one is the Weak scale, 10 to the 2 GeV. And this splitting between these two scales has been at the origin of the motivation to look for physics beyond the sound model for the last 30 years or more. People have realized that So you look at relative corrections to the Higgs mass of the sound model, you find that you need to adjust the bare parameter with a cutoff in order to get a small number. So if you assume that the bare parameter is of the order of 10 to the 2 GeV, and you take the cutoff where you think the sound model would break down to be of the order of the Planck scale, you see that you need some fine-tuning or adjustment between the two parameters in order to have Higgs mass, which is of the order of 10 to the 2 GeV. So that has been the motivation for physics beyond the standard model, the splitting between these two scales. But what do we know about the Planck scale? What is so special about it? Well, the way we think about it is just very naive. We take the constants we have in gravity and in quantum mechanics, and using dimensional analysis, we build quantities that are we call the Planck scale on the Planck mass, which is basically the square root of hc of a g, g being the Newton constant, c the speed of light, and h the parameter that quantizes from quantum mechanics. You have a Planck length using the same quantities, and you have a Planck time. And this Planck scale turns out to be huge. So there's nothing really special about it. And actually, people have shown that at least in extra dimension, if we live in more than 4D, you could have a scale for quantum gravity way lower than you would naively expect from purely dimensional analysis. And the two models that have created a lot of excitement in the last 10 years are basically the Akinyemi-Dimopoulos duality models and Ramasoni model. And the question we're interested in is whether we could lower the scale for quantum gravity in 4D as well. So let me first quickly recap why things work in extra dimension. So instead of having just d4x in extra dimension in front of your Ricci tensor, you have integration over this extra dimension. And you find that the Planck scale in 4D typically is given by the Planck, so that would be the Planck scale in 4D. That's given by the fundamental scale of gravity in this dimension times the volume of this dimension. So if you take a large volume, even if you have a small number, m star here, you can make MP big. So there are two realizations of this idea. The first one was this ADB model. You assume that we are confined to a four-dimensional brain and that only gravity sort of is allowed to propagate in what they call the bulk, so the extra dimensions. And another type of model is the Randall-Sundin wrapped extra dimension model, where you play on the fact that the extra dimension does not factorize from the four dimension, and you can adjust the brains in such a way that when you solve and find a solution, the weak scale appears to be rescaled compared to the value you would naively expect, and solve the hierarchy problem that way. So there are typical problems with models when you try to lower the scale for quantum gravity, and especially if you put it in a TV region. If you have extra dimension, typically you end up with light Kaluza-Klein modes of the gravitons, and that is typical for the model of ADD, and that leads to astrophysical constraints. And then you have to be worried of higher dimensional operators that can affect phenomenology like flavor changing neutral currents or proton decay, and you have to go to more complicated setup to protect the theory from these disasters. And in any case, you have a price to pay in the sense that you have to make assumptions about the shape or the size of these extra dimensions, and it's not completely obvious that you can realize these scenarios in the theory of quantum gravity, find a right vacuum out of these properties. So those are assumptions people are making about the shape of these extra dimensions or about the size. So, however, you gain a lot by making these assumptions. The first thing is that you can solve the hierarchy problem, because if there's no split in between the Planck scale, the fundamental parameter m star, and the weak scale, there's no hierarchy. There's no much running so in the Higgs mass, so there's no fine-tuning to explain. And furthermore, they lead to rich phenomenology at the LHC. In particular, people were very excited about the opportunity of having black holes or semi-classical black holes at the LHC. Now, can we do that in four dimensions? Okay, so I'm going to be talking about a very simple model. I take basically a scalar tensor theory, and that's a fancy word for a Dilaton-like theory. So the new feature is to have a potential for the scalar field. So instead of having a constant, instead of the Ricci scalar, I'm going to put a scalar field, which is basically a Dilaton. There's a kinetic term for this field. There will be a potential, and I will add a standard model, the usual standard model you are so familiar with. And I will have to discuss potential higher order operators that could destroy what I want to do. So that will be a big part of the talk, discussing what could go wrong and showing you that it works. The potential I will be selecting is a very simple one. So it's a real scalar field, and I take basically minus m star squared, phi squared, plus lambda to the fourth. Now, the scales of the theory are basically the weak scale, which is in the sound model, and m star. Okay, and what we have in mind is that this should be an effective field theory, which is valid up to a scale of, let's say, m star of the order of dV. So that is the scale where quantum gravity, whatever that is about, should replace the theory. Okay, now, let me assume that this Dilaton-like field, phi, gets a vacuum expectation value. And you see that if it gets a VEF, I will obtain a constant term in front of R, and that is basically what replaces the Planck scale, what should be the Planck scale. And you see that the Planck scale should be the square root of m star squared over 2 lambda. Now, remember that the Planck scale is this huge number, something like 2.4 times to 18 GeV. So if I take m star to be 1 TeV, that implies that lambda is a very small number, namely 8 times 10 to minus 32. Now, before you start shouting at me and tell me I'm completely crazy, I'll show you that this is not completely insane and that it can have naturally such a small number, that there's no fine-tuning involved. That is what's coming now. So if the dynamical assumptions I will be making about this higher order operators are valid, we have a solution to the hierarchy problem. We have two scales that are close to another. And basically, what I need in order to justify the choice of lambda is that the running of this parameter lambda be of this form. It should be some parameter lambda 0 plus a function that depends only on the self-coupling times some log of the scale. Now, if it is of this shape, there won't be much running, and it can be naturally of this order. It's technically natural to have a lambda of the order of 10 to minus 32. Now, it is important that this function f does not depend on gauge couplings or Yukawa couplings. That doesn't mean that there's no coupling between phi and the rest of the standard model. It just means that certain couplings can be there, others not. Basically, you're calculating an effective potential, so you see that if you have box phi times standard model operator, you'll be safe, because that will not contribute to the effective potential. To the question whether this model could be implemented in some fundamental theory, I'm not a string theory, I don't want to advocate too much string theory, but you could get this kind of model in the framework of little string theory. In that scenario, the four-dimensional Planck scale is related to the string coupling, and you have the string size, basically, the string scale, times the volume of the x1 dimension. Okay, so in that scenario, G string is very small, and that basically corresponds to a large mask for the for the dilaton. Thank you. Okay, so there is a high energy completion for that model, basically. So you could ask, so if that's really string theory, how would you differentiate that from ADD, for example? Well, in that scenario, the minimal length, so the fundamental scale of nature, is really 1 TV. So when you reach the scale, the string scale, you would have no way to probe this extra dimension. It would be some kind of, it would be fuzzy. So that would be a way to differentiate from ADD. Okay, so let me now tell you.
Isn't this the same thing as Joe-Leighton of Raoult scale?
This relation is basically due to Witten and Leighton at the same time. It's 96.
Mm-hmm.
And was, okay, I think Antoniadis had been playing with little string theory already in the early 90s. And they basically wrote a paper with Dimopoulos and Gibbon in 2001 re-explaining these ideas. But it goes back to Leighton and Witten, actually. Okay, so now this is really the crux of the problem. Is what I'm telling you realistic? Can it work? And if we have, so these are basically these little dots that are in my action, these higher dimensional operators. If we have a fundamental scale of the order 1 TV, namely, the scale to use to suppress higher order operators is 1 TV, so M star. So there's a bunch of operators you can write that are not forbidden by any of the symmetries of the problem that would destroy the scenario we have in mind. So operators of the type phi n suppressed by M star to the power n minus 4, or phi l times operators of the standard model suppressed by some power of M star, or this operator where you have box phi basically on the standard model suppressed by some scale, could potentially be dangerous, and especially the first two, and the first two operators will be dangerous. This one will not. So
next question: have you already explained why is gravity strong at M star?
Okay, that's an assumption. Okay. So we're putting ourselves in a scenario where quantum gravity is strong in one at M star.
Because I mean, if I look at your Lagrangian, and if I just ask if that Lagrangian gets strong at M star, when you add these higher dimension operators, I guess there'll be a scalar mode that becomes strong,
so
interacting.
Right. So basically,
self-interacting, but I don't see gravity being strong.
The scale that fixes gravity, that's a good point. Perturbative quantum gravity will be weak, and we'll come to that in the sequel. So the idea we have in mind is that we have quantum gravity at one TV. That is the scale we have in the matter. Perturbative quantum gravity will appear weak because of the VEF of this field, and I'll go to that into details in the following slides. But you're completely right, perturbative quantum gravity will be weak. So you will not have graviton emission, for example. Or, I mean, actually, you would have it, but with the usual 10 to 19 GeV coupling, which you will never see.
So with the spatial court has really become fuzzy in that situation?
Well, in that situation, what happens, so you have to imagine that this is an effective field theory that is valid here one TV, and you replace it by some fundamental theory, whatever you have in mind, string theory if you want, something else. So the details of what happens above one TV or just when you get there really depends on what type of theory you have in mind. So the question is whether you could realize that. Let's say I split the scale for the 10 to 19 GeV, the Planck scale, from the scale where gravity becomes strong. Can I build such a model and assume that, I mean, is it excluded that the scale for quantum gravity is one TeV in four dimensions, basically?
It's not in this model.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. I'm building a model that shows that it's possible that we live in such a world.
I don't see that. I mean, any theory of the type you've had written down there is equivalent to just Einstein gravity with no mixing between the scalar and the graviton, and the scalar just has some potential. And so I don't see that that class of models, so that's the class of whole class of models that you're dealing with, and I don't see how you can get strong gravity in that class
so
of models.
So basically, the one example with string theory, again, that is exactly this scenario where, let me go back, sorry.
So in string theory, but not in this model.
So that is basically a low energy realization of this model, where so in string theory, this is basically the string coupling that shows it to be 10 to minus 17, and that corresponds to a large dilaton mass. So the effective theory for that little string scenario is exactly that. The question is whether that is realizable, whether higher order operators would destroy this scenario.
It's also a question whether it's strongly interacting or not.
Where does that little string theory get strongly interacting?
Yeah, that's
well, that is basically the idea people have in mind, is that the string scale would be 1 TV. That is what they have in mind. Okay.
But that doesn't necessarily mean
GS
that gravity is strongly...
GS is tiny, so it's not strongly interacting.
Well, you will... That is... Okay. Again, the assumption here is that gravity becomes strongly interacting at 1 TeV. Now, I'm not telling you anything about the dynamics of the theory at 1 TeV, okay? But let me decouple the Planck scale from the scale at which gravity becomes strong.
So is you're just assuming that gravity gets strong at a TeV, and we could all make that assumption.
Yeah.
So then what issue are you exploring? And you can't see that in your model.
Well,
so
you will have...
You
yes, wait a second.
What
that
is the issue that you can
look, the kind of... What you will have typically as a signature are operators of this type that are reminiscent from strong gravity.
So you're looking at the phenomenology of operators.
I will come to that, okay? So, but the first thing is to discuss what are the operators that are going to be generated. And naively, again, if you had such a scenario, the first operators you write down are these. And when you insert a VEF for your scalar field in these things, you will see the VEF meaning 10 to 19 GeV. You see that this destabilizes your potential completely. So naively, the first thing you would think is it's not possible to build such a model. So that's what's interesting, basically. So if you insert a VEF for the scalar field here, you see that this is basically a huge contribution to your potential. And that would destabilize the first assumption I'm making. If we do get these operators, the theory is dead, and it's not possible to have gravity at one, strong gravity at 1 TeV. The second one typically leads to flavor changing Newton currents and potentially proton decay. And by integrating out standard model fields, we get again this kind of potential. So these two are deadly if they are there and suppressed by M star. Okay, so. The dynamical assumption we'll be making is that these things are not present, and we have to make sure that it... So any of these operators would typically be a problem for theories where you consider an effective theory close to the scale of quantum gravity, for example, Cauchy inflation. The last operator is not an issue because you see that if I put a VEF, it's basically vanishing, so it's just a a box phi copying to the standard model, and that is not dangerous for the theory. So the first question is whether you could generate these operators at the loop level. Okay, the first thing...
Does the third operator lead to mixing, though, between the phi and the standard model fields?
Yes, so that's basically the phenomenology you would have. That's a way to check the idea.
So this theory is, as you wrote it, I think it's even a weakly coupled scalar coupled to gravity if you go to Einstein, right? Is that true?
You will see that in a second. If you go to an Einstein frame, you would see a Dilaton coupling, basically.
I would see it actually a renormalizable theory.
It is not renormalizable. I mean, if you go to the Einstein frame, you will not find renormalizable couplings.
It's a non-renormalizable potential.
Yeah, so it's typically Dilaton theory, okay? So the first question is whether you get self-interactions. Well, self-interaction scale field can lead to large correction. So basically of the potential. So you look at diagram, you look at the effective potential, and you look at correction of this type, and you will see that, so those will be phis basically. You see that the couplings that enter the game are always a self-interaction. So these operators, although they would lead to things that are of this shape, to some power n minus 4, you see that they will always be suppressed by lambda to the power n minus n over 2. So basically, these will be small because lambda is small. They will not destroy the stability. They will not lead to instability of the potential. Then you have to be worried about what happens at the perturbative quantum gravity level. So that is the kind of diagrams you have to look at, phis with graviton in the loop. And the way to look at that is to do the calculation for the effective potential is to expand the scalar field around its VEF. And that leads to an expansion for the metric around the Minkowski space-time and the fluctuation h mu nu is suppressed by a scalar. It turns out when you normalize, and that is the observation Marcus was making, when you normalize the kinetic term for the graviton properly, that this scale here is basically the VEF of this field, in other words, M Planck, the 10 to 19 GeV. So basically, the scale for perturbative quantum gravity is weak. And so you do generate these operators, but they are suppressed by 10 to 19 GeV to some power. Now, this could still be an issue if the cutoff for my theory was high, but assume that the cutoff is of the order of 1 TeV, so these things will be of the shape 1 TeV to some power over 10 to 19 GeV to some power, so those will be small numbers, basically. So they do not destroy the assumption I made for the potential. Okay, so at the perturbative level, we are more or less safe. What about couplings to the Higgs sector? There are two operators you could write down. One is a dimension-full coupling times phi type H to H, where H is the doublet of the standard model. You have couplings phi squared H to H. Now, these both operators would destabilize completely the potential for the Higgs field if I put the VEF of the field phi here. So I'm going to assume that these operators are not present, and that is technically natural because phi is a singlet. So if I do not write down these operators at any scale, they will not be renormalized by any gauge interactions. Those are singlets, phi are singlets. So they can be zero, and the coefficient of these operators can be technically, naturally speaking, zero at every scale. And if you look at what happens with perturbative quantum gravity, you will see that you generate these operators, but these are basically small, and they will be suppressed by M Planck to the fourth power. So if you put M Planck here, you see that it's basically M Planck to the 2 suppressed by M Planck to the fourth power. This is still a small number, so this is safe. As long as the cutoff again is M star, which is 1 TeV. Okay. Nevertheless, these operators could be generated by non-perturbative physics. And if you have a theory of quantum gravity at 1 TeV, there is no reason why these operators would not be generated by non-perturbative quantum gravity. And there's no symmetry to prevent them, basically. So that is really the dynamic assumption we'll be making, which is equivalent to what people have made in the case of extra dimensions. These two operators are not generated. So people assume that the extra dimension of a certain shape, we assume that these two operators are not generated by non-perturbative effect. Again, they will not be generated by perturbative physics. And we will allow operators of this type, box phi, standard model suppressed by some scale, that would M star, that will be generated at a non-perturbative level. And this one is not dangerous and basically leads to interesting phenomenology.
Is there any reason to exclude mixed things like del squared phi, phi, or, you know, I don't know.
Delph?
Product of del squared phi and phi.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by del phi?
This that one. Suppose I multiplied by an extra phi. Is there some reason?
This one. Okay, yeah, well, you see that if you have a phi here, you probably will have. If I put the VEF of the field, that can be quite sizable. So you have to look into detail whether it probably depends on the amount of power you allow. I think that would be dangerous for the potential.
And so there's really a very large class of operators you're excluding.
But those are, again, that is,
Here,
honestly, I don't know what I'm talking about. It's non-perturbative physics, okay? So it's very difficult to have any control on these operators. I've shown at a perturbative level they won't be generated. But again, as any theory of quantum gravity, those are operators that could be there. Like operators that lead to quantum decay in the standard model, these are clearly have to be forbidden. You have the same issue in ADD before they do their more complicated assumption about symmetries that protect the Bayer number in the standard model. So that is a standard issue with TeV quantum gravity. It's a standard issue, for example, in inflation. If you think of the model that was developed by Linde, chaotic inflation, it's a standard issue for any model of quantum gravity. I mean, close to any effective theory close to the scale of quantum gravity.
Maybe I should wait a bit to see, but I'm sort of repeating Mark's question. What I see here is just you add to the standard model a scalar and claim that the cutoff of the whole system to be 1 TeV. And the only thing I see is the scalar operates in the minimally coupled to the gravity. The whole thing has nothing to do with quantum gravity.
Okay, again, you're in a scenario where the scalar field generate the scale for gravity, and that is something, the assumption we're making is that whatever quantum gravity theory you have in mind generates this potential for phi in the theory, okay? So again, this the only scale you have in the gravitational sector is M star, which is 1 T.
Maybe it should just be pointed out benefit of those who are not experts. In these other models, however, there is a much more sharp sense in which gravity is strong at TeV, namely that spin 2 scattering gets strong at TeV, and that black holes, production is actually enhanced, not because of assumption, but by a calculation in the physics that's put in. So here, be an assumption being made, a statement being made that gravity is being strong, but it's not showing up. Strong is not showing up at this level.
It is a scalar tenth theory of gravity, okay? That's the first remark I want to make. It's not purely GR as in these models. Secondly, about black hole formation, we'll get into the details, but even this extra dimensional model, it is very unlikely that black holes will be seen at the LHC for different reasons I will explain later during my talk. Thirdly, these operators are clearly a sign of strong coupling of the scalar tensor gravity to the standard model.
Of the scalar?
Yes, but that is the theory of gravity we're looking at. It's a scalar tensor theory, which is basically a dilaton theory that string B-lovers get all the time with a potential for the scalar field.
I think the question really being asked is why can't this just come from strong dynamics with an extra scalar phi?
Okay. It is coupled in a very specific way. It's coupled like a dilaton.
Yeah, but I mean, I could take QCD, just real QCD.
Yeah.
Low energy QCD is pions. Now I could make a right infective Lagrangian for the pions. Now I could redefine the G mu nu, okay?
Sure.
And I could make that theory look like your theory.
Well,
and then you would look at that theory and say, gee, it's a scalar tensor theory of gravity, and it's getting strong at a GeV. And that's actually nature. That theory actually describes
nature.
Fine,
but But don't forget one.
We don't think about it
that,
that
is
way.
Not,
the way
that
we
is
think about it is that gravity stays weak and this sector goes strong.
Look,
the
way
this is, the scalar tensor theory of gravity is just not an invariant statement.
Your scalar field would not generate the scale of quantum gravity, okay? Of gravity.
Yeah, well, the way I write it, it will. I can also write your theory in such a way that the scalar is not generating.
Well,
the
obviously,
scalar gravity, I just make a field redefinition.
That's what you're telling me is you want to go to another frame. But that
yeah.
Clearly, the way you define things is frame dependent, okay?
No, they give the same physics, the two
so that's not
which
correct.
The Lagrangian you use.
The way the invariant length, ds squared, basically, is dependent on the. So the way you define energies and compare energies is dependent on the frame.
I mean, it depends on how it couples
yeah.
to matter.
Sure.
So what you're inducing is different. In this language, you're changing the scalar couple. You're making assumptions about how the scalar couples
right.
matter.
Right. That is correct.
So the only way I can understand this is if this third operator that you're introducing might come from somewhere. Does that make gravity strong? I mean, if M
basically,
star sits there,
imagine,
gravity,
okay, again, a typical example.
Get strong as a result?
Imagine this little string theory where you have basically a dilaton theory with a potential, a large mass for the dilaton. That would be a realization for a quantum theory of gravity of 1TV with exactly that potential. So there's nothing weird about that. Okay, so what is the phenomenology of this model? So in a sense, it's very similar to the standard model. There's no Kalutzak line excitation. So it will not be bounded from observation of no astrophysics. There's no sizable modification of the Newton law. And gravity emission, because the scale for periodic quantum gravity is so small, will not lead to sizable effects at colliders. As you have emphasized, what happens in that model is really that you would see the dynamics of the scalar field around 1TV. This scalar field will not be able to hide anymore. And the question is, what are the bounds in this model? What do we know about from present data about that? And could you, in principle, create black holes in such a model?
So could this operator lead to graviton emission or not?
This one, no.
So why not?
You have strong... Okay, because the standard model... So you could produce some phis. So if you have a standard model field coming in, you could have phis being emitted. But the phi couples only weakly to gravity. So you would not create black holes at a collider.
Well, I'm just worried right now about graviton emission. I mean,
remember, we have, when you look at what happens for the, when you expand the metric around eta mu, you see that the scale is basically for your expansion.
Oh, and you say the dev is phi
yeah.
is implying.
So you will never see gravitons being emitted at a collider. It's a very weak coupling.
Okay.
So could you produce black holes in that scenario? And so the first thing to do is to review why people think that black holes can be produced in ADD or Ramazzoni. Now, in trivial situations, it's easy to solve. So basically, what matters is spherical. You can solve Einstein's equations explicitly, and you find the Schwarzschild metric, for example. In more complicated cases where matter is not as nice and you cannot solve things explicitly, and you have to find some other criteria. And one criteria that has been used in astrophysics and verified by numerical simulations in that framework is the Hooke conjecture that goes back to Keith-Thorne. And it says that if you put an amount of energy E, and you confine this amount of energy E to a ball size R, and if you choose the size to be smaller than any amount of energy, so I put G Newton 1 equal to 1, H bar and so on equal to 1. Sorry, C equal to 1. And you will find that this region will eventually evolve into a black hole. So if you have a region of space-time with a matter distribution, and you can pass a group around size R around that matter, the matter, it will eventually evolve, things will evolve, eventually evolve to a black hole. So if you use this conjecture, you can calculate a cross-section to produce a black hole. And it is basically given by this geometric cofactor, which is pi times the Schwarzschild radius squared. And this is the Schwarzschild radius in 4 plus n dimensions. Now, the thing which is remarkable about this cross section is that it grows with energy. If you think, so that would be a cross section for the proton, basically. If you go to proton collider, you will see that you have to replace the black hole mass by the center of mass energy. So those are cross sections that could, in principle, dominate anything you see in the sound model. Now, is that thing valid when you have more complicated cases like particle colliding towards another? And the rigorous thing to do, or more rigorous thing to do, is to prove that you have closed trapped surface. And basically, closed trapped surface is a compact space like two surfaces in space-time, such that outgoing new rays are perpendicular to the surface and do not expand. So mathematically, that means that if you take a sphere S, so this is the sphere inside, you emit a flash of light. At the later time, the light from a point P forms a sphere F, now around P. You have two envelopes, S1 and S2, that form the ingoing and outgoing wavefronts. And if the area of both S1 and S2 are less than the original surface S, then you have formed a closed trap surface. Now, it is a very weird space-time if you have such things, okay? Because typically in flat space-time, you always expect that one of them is bigger than the other, as shown here. So something is very weird going on. Now, I'm not an expert at all of this field. I'm still learning about it, but people like Hawking and Penrose have shown us that if we have a closed trap surface, then there is a singularity in the future evolution of Einstein equation. Now, that is basically, so that's a theorem due to Hawking and Penrose. You have to assume some output, you make some hypotheses about the energy momentum tensor, basically the matter is not too weird. Then, if you assume this cosmic censorship conjecture, which says that there's no naked singularities, that all naked singularities are hidden from an observer infinity by an event horizon, then that means that singularities in the evolution of Einstein equation imply that there's a black hole, that black hole will form. So Hawking, Penrose, plus the cosmic censorship conjecture lead to the conclusion that if you can prove that there's a closed trap surface, you have proven that a black hole will form as well. Okay, so the situation we're talking about now is the one of two particles colliding towards each another with an impact parameter which is non-zero. And the question is whether, in that case, you can apply the Hooke conjecture to calculate the cross-section. Now, in the case of a zero impact parameter, people have known for 20 years, since Penrose, actually, that this is a case. But in a situation like the LHC, you have to think of an impact parameter which is non-zero. And the resolution of the problem came in 2002 by Ernie and Giddings, who have shown that in that case, you do create a closed trap surface. And the idea basically is to consider the so-called Eichenberg Sexton metric, which is basically a Schwarzschild metric which you boost, and you take a limit where of a large boost and a small mass for the particle. And the thing which is important, okay, so that is this metric. The fact that it is linked to the Schwarzschild solution is apparent here in this differential equation that defines the coordinate phi that appears here. The thing which is interesting is that this is basically singular at x equals 0 because of the delta function, and it describes a shock wave. And so the Schwarzschild radius here is really related to the Newton constant that appears in the Einstein equation. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, the way they do their construction is to consider two particles, so coming from minus infinity, minus infinity, basically, and that is what you see here in the space-time diagram. And they are able to construct a closed-track surface before particles have had time to, so the shock waves have had time to interact. So it's purely based on classical physics. There's no quantum gravity involved, so their result is trustworthy, basically. And that this construction works as long as the impact parameter is smaller than 1.6 times the Schwarzschild radius you obtain from the Hooke conjecture. It is really a semi-classical process. Diffieux has shown that you can write a path integral and define an asymmetric element for that process. Okay. Okay. So basically what happens is that the cross-section you obtain from the naive Hooke conjecture get modified by a factor that you can calculate analytically for the dimension. That is what early in Giddings have done. Note that their result is strictly valid when you go to an infinite center of mass energy, and people tend to use it in cases where it's not the case, but that's the only case where you can really trust the result. So that means for basically collider physics, when the mass of the black hole is very large compared to the scale of quantum gravity. Now, the case took some dimension. So early in Giddings have done a calculation for more than four dimensions as well, but had to be solved numerically, and this has been done by Yoshino and Nambu, who basically have calculated the rescaling here parameter for numerically for n bigger than 4. Since, as a summary, you can produce semi-classical black holes, and well, there's a very nice argument that has been, you know, basically agrees with that's the result of early Giddings that have been given by two people here. But the crux for the model we have in mind is that what appears in our construction, I mean, this construction is not M star, but it's really, sorry, it's really MP, not M star. Okay, so let me go.
That's true for your model?
That is true basically for all model. So it's really the fundamental scale of gravity you have in mind that appears there. I mean, of perturbative gravity. Should be. Now, let me quickly explain the significance for models of like and so on. So that is the cross section people were expecting before the work of Erling Giddings. So although you expect that the cross section grow with energy, the Pauli distribution functions start to dominate fast, and that's why things go down faster than you would expect. And so if you take the work of early Giddings and Co. into account, that is the cross-section you obtain. On top of that, you see that this is for a mass of 1 TeV, a black hole mass of 1, sorry, a fundamental scale of 1 TeV. Excuse me, that's a wrong, that should be a black hole mass. So you see that most events are in a region where the approximation is not under control. You cannot trust the early Giddings construction in that region. So
what is the M on your lower axis there?
M is the fundamental scale of gravity, I'm sorry. That is basically cross-section proton to black hole plus anything. And this should be M black hole. So you have to choose.
The bottom should be M star then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I got this plot from this paper. But it's a nice way to see. So basically, that is a statement that, you know, this inelasticity, the fact that you can't put all the energy you have in the gravitational wave into the black hole formation kills you basically for black hole formation.
I don't understand what changed between those two curves.
Okay, what changed is people took into account this number that is energy dependent. So when you...
It's not just a number.
Yeah, it is energy dependent. So when you go through the pattern function distribution business, you have to make sure that you take that into account. It makes your life more complicated, and that basically reduces the cross-section dramatically. And again, you end up in the... having a region, I mean, most even in a region where you can't trust what you're saying. Okay, so again, you can, so the kind of black holes people would create in six-ray dimension are not semi-classical black hole, but you would have black hole decay into radiation. Those are the very significant events people were thinking about, but you would more have strong rescattering, very similar to the kind of events we are thinking about for scalar fields. So if you would have two particles coming in going to a few events. Okay, and the key here is to remember that the early Giddings construction only works for black hole masses that are much bigger than the scale of quantum gravity. Okay, so those are the Einstein equation in our case. You see that basically you have the usual terms on the left-hand side. You have regular matter, which is T mu, and S mu are this interaction, the scalar field with the self-interaction and interaction with the structure of gravity, R meaning R. So the important fact is that G is small here. In, as you stress correctly, in extra dimensional model, G would be much bigger. I mean, it would be in the corresponding to 1 TeV. So in our case, what we have to use in the early Giddings construction is G of the order of 1 over 10 to 13 GeV squared. So we will not produce semi-classical black holes in our case. And again, unfortunately, ADD in Ranasanam will not be able to produce black holes at the NHC, most likely because of the reason we've been talking about. So they're talking about now having some strong rescattering effects, more like compositeness effects. Okay, what are the bounds on this idea, basically? Oh, yeah, one point is that you could also hope to restore a phase of unbroken symmetry where gravity would be very strong, but you see that using these operators, for example, but you see that the amount of energy you have to furnish is huge. This potential is quite deep, basically of the order of m Planck squared times m star squared. So it's hopeless to restore a phase of strong gravity. Okay, so the way people have put limits on extra dimensions is by looking at cosmic rays, which are the highest energetic physical data we have nowadays. These bounds may apply no more because basically the kind of black holes that could actually be produced in their case are quantum black holes, which are analogous to strong rescattering involving these scalar fields. And so there we would have only a few particles that are being produced that could still be energetic and produce further showers. And the bounds that are available nowadays are from AGESA, which stands for Akeno Giant Air Shower Array. And basically the idea is to compare what you would expect from the standard model. So you would think of very high energetic neutrinos coming in that would be either coming horizontally to the Earth and create a shower, or they would come skimming in the Earth, basically, would transform into a lepton, they would come out and decay into another shower. So that's what you expect in the standard model. Now, if you have black hole formation, you could create a black hole in the Earth crust that would not escape because it would decay hadronically also, and you would have less event than you expect in that case.
So I'm losing track, I'm losing the train of thought. So you've argued that there may be some trouble in actually producing black holes in these extra dimensional
yes.
scenarios. What are you saying about black hole production in your model?
Okay, I'm saying black hole production in my model is excluded. Unless you have some very weird non-locality effects.
Okay.
Now, you can try to use the bound people have put...
So is it relevant? I'm not understanding the relevance.
Okay, basically, the work by Ringwald, Feng, and collaborators applies only to really quantum black holes. Okay, that's for the reason we've been talking about. What you produce are not semi-classical black holes if the mass of the black hole is close to the scale of quantum gravity. So what we have in mind is that you could produce some of these pi particles that would create further showers. So in a sense, it would be similar to strong rescattering. So we can try to use these bounds to put a knife. We have very energetic particles coming in neutrinos that could couple to this phi and create some showers in the similar to what people would get from strong rescattering. So it's not a one-to-one correspondence, I agree with you, but it gives us an idea of what the bounds are. So similarly, so people expect that, you know, you've seen Hooke conjecture, you have a very energetic neutrino hitting on a nucleon, you could create a black hole, although it would not be a semi-classical black hole, most likely again. They use the Hooke conjecture. From that, at the problem level, you get a cross-section at the problem level, you have to fold it with the problem distribution function to get a cross-section neutrino to neutron to black hole. And your important observation is that the cross-section grows with the center of mass energy. Now, the number of black holes or black holes-like event that AGASA could have seen depends on the neutrino flux, the Avogadro number, the cross-section you obtain here, and the acceptance and the time of running of the detector. So I think the time of running is about 5 years. The cross-section can be calculated. The acceptance is given by this expression. They have to know about the density of the atmosphere at the ground level, and they have to basically know the probability of finding a shower of energy E at a zenith angle theta, starting at some altitude H. And then you have to model the neutrino flux And Dart is also part of uncertainty in their bounds, so there are different models for dimensional flux, but we're talking about very high energetic events. Okay. So it's a complicated business. You potentially have large uncertainties, and what's relevant for us is that the kind of bound you can put is fairly independent on a number of extra dimension and typically of 1.5 TeV. Now they've updated the bound to take into account the inelasticity, so that's this early Giddings thing, but doesn't impact the bounds tremendously. So using that, we deduce a bound on a cross-section of basically what we would call strong rescattering due to the phis, and that gives us a bound of the order of 1 TeV for the Planck's M star, if we assume that the cross-section go as 1 over M star squared, which is quite conservative too. I mean, it's a conservative assumption.
But I thought these bounds depended on the assumed properties of the black hole decay. I mean,
yeah.
So that, I mean, large black hole will decay sort of to everything equally because it's roughly thermal. And at least for the collider bounds, that was crucial. So I'm not familiar with these, but
so
I would
here,
think that that's very
no,
important
because
what it decays to. No?
It is not very important in the sense that they never see these. So if you remember that slide, so the reason why there's a bound is that if you have a scenario where you create black holes, there's a certain probability, and here we're talking about one event a year, okay, for all these kind of things, few events a year, there's a certain probability for the neutrino to create a black hole in the Earth's crust, and that will not get out. It decays to hydrons, things like that, it will interact with the matter in the Earth. So these things will not, so it doesn't depend, so that's why the bound kind of applies, okay? It doesn't depend to what the black hole would decay. It's just you just have to assume strong rescattering. That is a bound on strong rescattering, more than anything else.
So
okay.
If you don't see it, that means they're measuring the number of neutrinos that disappear, or
well, if you had just done a model, you can compare the ratio of having neutrinos decaying to a shower here to the one that would create a. So you can evaluate the number of events you would have for each case. Then you know that you would lose some events basically due to black hole formation.
So they can normalize that.
Yeah, think exactly. Okay, oops, for some reason the color didn't come out, but it's quite interesting to see. Well, okay, this path is supposed to show you the bounds on models of extra dimension, and it's quite remarkable that a cosmic ray allowed to put the toughest bound for higher. And dimension higher than 5. So here you don't see it, but you should have the bounds from astrophysics for n equal 2 and 3 and 4 as well. And you see that cosmic ray start to dominate the bounds for higher number of extra dimension. Okay, so basically what we know, and it's not a surprise because any theory or modification of some model 1 TeV has, roughly speaking, a bound of 1 TeV, is that the bound for a model is of the order of 1 TeV. So the kind of phenomenology you would have at the ADHC would be strong rescattering, so you would have proton going to some new physics, and it's difficult to quantize what we mean by new physics. It depends on this strong non-perturbative dynamics, but you would have big cross-section, potentially of the order of 10 to 7 femtobar for a scale of new physics of 1 TeV. And with a luminosity of 100 intracentibars, you would get something like 10 to 9 events at the ADHC. So
this
again,
is from which operator?
Basically, we have in
mind. Phi operator,
yes,
or?
We have in mind that this kind of operators, non-perturbative physics, would create contact-like interaction and lead to cross-section of the order of 1 over m star squared. So indeed, the scenario is very, in the end, very similar to what people expect nowadays in Raman syndrome, in the sense that it would be tough to create black holes, and what you would see are typically, I mean, would resemble compositeness in the sense you would have higher order operators suppressed by some scale, and that might be the first way to probe quantum gravity at 1 TeV. It's worth noting that if you don't like to play with Fortran, you have an official CTEC package for partial differential function, which is available under this web address. It makes life much easier when you have to deal with models like that. And you cannot use the simple, you cannot use the programs that people have designed for black hole simulators, for example, in a scenario, or you cannot use MATGraph. So you have to do calculations by hand, and it's nice to have a mathematical package to get the cross section at the problem level. Okay, so I think it's fair to say that there are different options for TV quantum gravity, whether it's actually mentioned in four dimension. And again, we don't know much about the scale of gravity, and it's quite remarkable that a simple model like that is not excluded in the sense that it works, that perturbative physics does not generate operators that kill the assumption you make about the potential for your dilaton. So in that sense, even if we wait for dimension, quantum gravity could be around the corner, and that is really an experimental question. So that's something that LHC people will be able to tell us. We do not expect black holes to be produced unless some very weird physics that works, non-local physics that work. But in any case, we will have some strong dynamics that will be a clear signal that something fun is going on, like producing these phis. And the other thing is that it's a fascinating unification between gravity and weak physics. I'm back to my first slide. Not only have we put both scales for gravity, M star, and the scale, roughly speaking, on the same level, but both are generated via Higgs effect, and that I think is a very nice feature of this little model. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, I have lots of questions, I guess. In the del squared phi standard model operator, why doesn't it work to some approximation to replace del squared phi using the equation of motion? That would give you back another factor of m star. So
okay,
you know, given how small lambda is.
So if you're saying
box phi is, yeah, should be
yeah,
more
so
less
that is
m
surprised
star squared.
Yeah.
Times phi.
Well, it really depends on the kind of operator you have in mind, okay? So you're saying the equation of motion, well, what about the equation of motion for phi? Let me go back to you. You're saying, well, you know, it's going to be m star in the worst case scenario. So it's going to be m star in the worst scenario. So
well, I would just take your potential there and say lambda is extremely tiny. So
lambda, okay, that is indeed an issue.
And you're saying that the interactions with gravity are weak.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't I just use the approximate equation of motion for del phi with m star squared, minus m star squared, or whatever, for phi?
So, if you just, so it would be just, you would recover the standard model, basically, operator. That's what you tell me, if I understand correctly.
Well, it would just change the way you're doing your counting over here, so that it would be as suppressed. It would still be a mixing between phi and the standard model.
But the counting is, so you would have some power of m star, which depends on what kind of operator you have in mind, okay, the dimension of the sum of operators, and so on. So all you would have is basically.
So when you say there's
you
an observable phenomena at the LHC, what kind of OSM?
Yeah, well,
you put in there
that really depends. You can think of psi, something like that, log psi. So that again is those kind of operator would be generated at non-perturbative level. And that's why it's very difficult to tell you precisely what will happen. But again, they're not forbidden by any symmetry. So if you ask me what I think about this model, is that this model is really dead for the reason that these operators will be generated. But that is deadly for every model. And that's why we had a question mark about the TV gravity thing. These operators typically will be generated at a non-perturbative level. That's what makes life difficult for action physics. Those are the operators that make life difficult in ADD as well. There's no reason why such operators will not be generated. So there's no symmetry that prevents that. So the only thing you can do is assume they're not there, but then there are indeed this operator where you could have anything with, you know, standard like physics, type bar, psi, Higgs. You have to be careful. The one with the D, yeah, you could have these. That's probably fine. So these kind of things. But again, it's very difficult to give you a quantitative reason for, you know, what to expect here. Again, the only thing you can guess is what is allowed by the symmetry of the problem. But I think that those kind of operators are the reason why it's tough to believe in TV gravity, whether you have extra dimensions or four dimensions. So you can imagine having fermions, the Higgs sector, Higgs field. That's the kind of bridges you can, that are not deadly for the model. And again, I think it's not well known, but it's also an issue for chaotic inflation. This operator in particular would destabilize completely the scenario they have in mind. So, and again, unfortunately, this is generic when you try to build an effective field theory, which has to be valid till the quantum gravity scale, and where you consider your physics at this with fields that have values bigger than the scale of quantum gravity.
I mean, isn't it plain that extra dimensional models that things are under control?
Well, again, things like prone decay can be under control because they find a way to put a symmetry that prevents some operators. But these kind of things at a non-perturbative level, there's no reason why they would not be there. It's a generic issue. And again, non-perturbative means no one knows what they're talking about. But there's no symmetry that prevents them. So in a sense, if you refute this kind of idea, you have to refute, you know, any model that has this kind of operators.
Any other questions? Okay, well, that's done here again.